I can't square that these words, or suggest these words somehow will solve, S-A-L-V-E, or even reconcile the atrocities of the past. But in the spirit of acknowledgement and truth and healing, I also think it's important that we invite you to help us understand that truth by encouraging the creation of a Truth and Healing Council.
So that was the governor of California apologizing for the genocide of Native Americans. And joining us, as always, Nick Yellowhorse. Nick.
Yes.
Thoughts.
Hi there.
Wait. I know we're cutting it close.
Hello. Oh, yes. Yeah, there's a lot to talk about. I mean, I think the most blatant question out of all of this is what action is coming after this? What action do we have proposed in any type of government council that California currently has? Mm-hmm. Yes, they are acknowledging murdered and missing Indigenous women, and they do have one of the highest rates of any state. But what is the action? What action are they trying to think or even put into plan? What are the steps to begin the process?
Yep.
That's the main issue, right? Is that, I'm sorry, the main question after all of this.
So they're doing a truth and reconciliation, just like Canada, they're doing a truth and reconciliation kind of council of sorts. But time will tell if it ends up just being a, we'll tell us how to fix it. Like, you do the work, putting it back on us to do the work, to tell them how to fix it, which is not how it should be. And we all know how well truth and reconciliation is going for our neighbors up north.
True. I mean, they're in that situation, they're saying, look, we made a mess, can you please fix it for me?
Yeah.
And this mess wouldn't have been caused in the first place if they didn't have all these bills and orders for us to have us exterminated. Because I know there are many Indigenous populations out there that have a lot of ties and have a lot of claims to that land spanning the borders. Mm-hmm. And in the end, what action could we see? What action should we see? And I believe one, it might have been Winona LaDuc, said something about this, and she said the only solution is land for land.
The preceding program was produced at KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon. More audio can be found online at kboo.fm.
K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Plugged In on KBOO is a radio show dedicated to underground electronic music. The show is hosted by DJ Tronic and features deep house, tech house, techno, drum and bass, breakbeats, future bass, down tempo, and more. Plugged In frequently has local producers and DJs on the show, and we provide info about upcoming events in Portland, including free ticket giveaways. Plugged In airs the first and third Friday of every month from 10 p.m. to 12 a.m. Pacific time.
Tune in to KBOO every fourth Friday of the month at 8 p.m. for Squirrel Snow, the show where we broadcast galactic awareness, animal awareness, where we have fascinating conversations with movers and shakers in the fields of galactic awareness and animal awareness, and we play music that can raise our frequency of consciousness. Yeah, that is Squirrel Snow every fourth Friday of the month at 8 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO, Portland.
Hi, it's Al Franken telling you to listen to KBOO, KBOO, Community Radio 90.7 here in Portland.
Activist Radio!
Some folks are born made to wave the flag. Oh, they're red, white, and blue. But when the band plays Hail to the Chief, they point the cannon right at you. It ain't me, it ain't me, I ain't no senator's son. It ain't me, it ain't me, some folks are born silver spoon in hand.
Oh, well, that's a little bit of Fortunate Son by Todd Snyder. We used this intro for a number of years, including the cheer that starts it off, and that cheer came from a children's program that came before Activist Radio. And every time we were announced as taking over, they would give us a little cheer like that. So we played that maybe more than we should have. But anyway, this is your introduction to Activist Radio today, where we're doing something a little bit different. This is a special program of Activist Radio. We're still going to offer some history you didn't learn in high school. We still have some news programs you haven't seen on TV. We have plenty of music to help you join the resistance. And Activist Radio, we can be heard Thursdays 5 to 6 p.m. on WVKR 91.3 FM at Vassar College in Poughkeepsie, New York. Thursdays from 7 to 8 p.m. on WBDY, that's 99.5 FM at the Bundy in Binghamton, New York. Sundays 1:30 to 2:30 p.m. on WESU, that's 88.1 FM at Wesleyan University in Middletown, Connecticut. Sundays 4 to 5 p.m. from the WIOF, that's 104.1 FM in Woodstock, New York. And Sundays 5 to 6 p.m. from the Progressive Radio Network, and you can find them at prn.live. Past programs are available as a podcast. Search for Activist Radio on iTunes, Google Play, Digital Podcast. Any of them will get you there. You can also listen to us anytime on the web at classwars.org. Our guest today is going to be, and this is a selection of one of our top interviews over the last year, Slado, a spokesperson for the Gymtian Checkpoint, a reoccupation site established in 2018. She's the member of Kas Yaka, which is the Grizzly House, and as you would have guessed by now, she's a First Nation. She's part of the Wet'suwet'en people. So it's an interesting interview with Slado, and that will come about half an hour through the program. This brings us to the views and opinions expressed on this program. They're still not necessarily those of the station, its board of directors, or its constituents. And there's just the views of me today, Fred, and I'm bringing you up to date on America's hidden class wars.
Idiot. Don't want a nation under the new media. And can you hear the sound of hysteria? The subliminal minds through America. Welcome to a new kind of tension all across the alien nation. Everything isn't meant to be okay. Television dreams of tomorrow, we're not the ones who are meant to follow. Well, that's enough to argue.
So that's part of Green Day. Song is American Idiot. And of course we used that for a number of years as well as the introduction to the first part of Activist Radio. We would discuss a little history you didn't learn in high school. Well, today we're going to take, as I say, a different approach. We're going to look at the spread of fascism in America, and that's deeply part of American history and not a recognized part at all, but it's something that we as citizens have to take a close look at now. Well, we're going to go to an article I wrote about a year and a half ago for the LA Progressive. The article was entitled The Unspoken Spread of Fascism. So I thought I would read that article. I've reread it a couple times, and it was written before January 6th, of course, so that we have so much more information about the spread of fascism in the U.S. But I'm going to read the article as I published it, and then we're going to talk just a little bit about what's happened since that article was published. So here it is, The Unspoken Spread of Fascism. It's difficult for most Americans to judge just how dangerous Donald Trump might be. It's not that the clues are missing. There's a daily list of lies, racist comments, misogynist ramblings, and outrageous self-dealing. But most citizens just don't have the right vocabulary to put his actions into some sort of context, even in these pandemic times. The left has been more confident about where Trump fits in the general run of very bad presidents. He is simply a fascist, whose behavior is very similar to other calamitous dictators who we've seen in the 20th century. This conclusion becomes increasingly believable when Trump talks about confrontation, the confrontation that would happen if he doesn't get his own way. Quote, I can tell you, and I have the support of the police, the support of the military, the support of the bikers for Trump. I have the tough people. But they don't play it tough until they go to a certain point, and then it would be very, very bad. Of course, that was a quote from Trump. Trump really is not talking about the workings here of a democracy, or the endlessly touted separation of powers between Congress, executive, and the judiciary. Bikers for Trump is simply a brown shirt organization waiting for their leader's call to violence. And of course, January 6th really proved that all this was possible. You know, he was talking about what would come at the end of his presidency, or what he was in his mind he was thinking of what would come if he wasn't elected. Continuing with the article here. Yet the term fascist rarely gets used in polite company. The New York Times is especially careful not to offend mainstream sensibilities. When the word fascist is used in print, it always refers to supposed foreign enemies of the state. The term is never used to refer to Americans in high office, no matter how egregious or brutal their crimes have been. Getting past this simplistic use of the term for enemy leaders, there are some aspects of fascism that fit Trump quite exactly. Comparing Trump's behavior to the list of fascist characteristics created by the Italian scholar Umberto Eco in his essay Eternal Fascism is especially revealing. Trump believes in sudden decisions rather than reflection, or as Eco describes it, quote, the cult of action for action's sake, unquote. Eco's fascists often equate disagreement of their policies with treason, and so too does Trump. Fascist leaders cultivate the, quote, the fear of difference, unquote, which encourages racist aggression towards minorities and foreigners. In Trump's world, Mexicans are rapists, Muslims are terrorists. Echo refers to another characteristic as, quote, an obsession with plot. And Trump's conspiracies come straight from the right-wing websites without the least pretense of fact-checking. Trump's own life is a perpetual battle, something he probably learned from his father's lawyer, one of the chief strategists of the McCarthy era, and that was Roy Cohen. Echo describes this as, quote, the life of permanent warfare. Another of Echo's characteristics of a fascist is the contempt for the weak, or as Trump would put it, referring to John McCain, quote, I like soldiers who don't get captured, unquote. Trump's bragging about his power to assault women, to grab them by the blank, fits well into Echo's description of machismo, the application of perpetual war to the sphere of sexuality. This tendency is well documented in the way Trump has treated the rights of women and the LGBTQ community. Echo describes fascist leaders as being selective populists in an attempt to manipulate economic discontent into political power, becoming in effect the interpreter of the popular will. Trump's efforts to kill environmental regulations, close the Mexican border, and end abortion rights are his analysis of what the population wants. In this way, economic anger is redirected towards the goals that don't present a challenge to the rule of the rich elite. Finally, Echo refers to, quote, newspeak, the language of Oceania, or George Orwell's fictional totalitarian state. In 1984, the novel, the ruling class controls thought by limiting language. Vocabulary is diminished, ideas are grossly simplified, and any discussion of morality reduced to black and white. Or to put it in Trump speak, all people and all events are either tremendous or very bad. Jacobo Timmerman, in his Prisoners Without a Name, Cell Without a Number, adds nuance to this concept of diminished language and simplified ideas. The fascist authorities in Argentina during Timmerman's incarceration feared and hated complexity. Editors like himself were suspect, but so too were psychoanalysts and academics. Multifaceted concepts and theories were considered subversive in themselves, and writing about them often resulted in prison and torture. Finally, quote, making America great again, unquote, never involves more thought than watching Fox News or chanting racist slogans. News is either real or fake. Prospective immigrants are either great or from S-word countries. One characteristic of fascism missing from more recent descriptions can be traced all the way back to Mussolini's Minister of Education, that was Giovanni Gentile, who wrote about what he called corporatism. The word itself has a long history in political theory, but to Gentile, it meant an enforced harmony between social classes, workers, employers, and the state. Harmony, of course, with one person at the top making most of the decisions. It was an attractive concept for the ruling class, since corporatism would eliminate labor demands and leftist ideologies. Quote, and above all, wrote Mussolini in 1932, quote, fascism denies that class war can be the preponderant force in transformation of society, unquote. On the surface, Mussolini's rise to power in the early 1920s had little to do with corporatism. It was based on squads of black shirts that murdered thousands of socialists and unionists all across the country. Hitler employed very similar tactics starting in the late 1920s, using his brown shirts to beat, to assassinate anyone who opposes Nazi agenda. Less recognized, however, is the fact that both terrorist organizations had elite corporate sponsorships. For Mussolini, that support started as early as 1922 and remained consistent until the end of World War II. For Hitler, corporate money came later in 1928 after he had purged the socialist elements of his party. While Gentile's definition of corporatism did not include payoffs by the rich elite to Mussolini, the support of this class proved to be a critical piece in his ascent to power. The same is true of Hitler. Before 1928, he consistently lacked funding, was constantly recognizing the impediment to achieving complete control. After that date, however, the major corporations saw Hitler as a way to destroy unions and socialist resistance, and to ensure profits. Is this same phenomenon at work today in paving the way for Trump's rise to power? An interesting Market Watch study conducted 2 years into Trump's presidency found that despite his reckless behavior and contempt for the democratic process, the nation's top CEOs were given almost 3 times as much to Republicans as Democrats. And that just scratches the surface, since most donations to the major parties come from company PACs and dark money, controlled in large part by this same CEO class. The 1920s were similar to the last decade in several ways. Industrialist countries saw the rich elite prosper greatly during both periods, giving them much more money to influence their political systems. At the same time, economic discontent became more overt as the majority of workers became unable to support their families. Rage at the system became a distinct threat to the very wealthy. Have the CEOs and the very rich in our time reacted in the same way as they did in the 1920s? Are they in fact funding authoritarian leaders who will protect their corporate profits, using racism and nationalism to turn anger at the system into anger at immigrants, minorities, anyone who disagrees with them? By avoiding the use of the word fascism, mainstream media analysis fails our democracy in 2 ways. First, we as citizens can't look at Trump and judge him by historical standards. His actions may be outrageous, deplorable, but we remain oblivious to the pattern of a fascist leader that he exhibits. The second way that media fails is to limit how fascism is described. It's always a person rather than a national movement, a Netanyahu rather than the Israeli people, or a Hitler rather than all Germans. Fascism may be encouraged by someone with the right combination of charisma and viciousness, but in the end it becomes a social illness that moves whole populations towards war and genocide. Perhaps fascism is the madness that comes from true corporatism, or from its most recent manifestation, neoliberalism. It's a deadly mix of greed at the top, misdirected rage at the bottom, and a fascist leader who can turn it all into an engine of mindless destruction. There is no need to review the obvious dangers that such societies pose to our species and to our planet. All right, I thought of a number of things, you know, while reading that. One thing that was totally left out is the control of the courts, the right-wing control of the courts. And I could have gotten back and drawn parallels to Italy and Germany in the 1930s. There were battles there about control of the courts as well. So I think that's something, if I would rewrite this article, I think I would also include the control of the courts, because lots of state power is right there. And another thing that I really sort of left out in this article, I think, is the infiltration of police and military. And Trump talks about the fact that the military and the police are going to be on his side. And that's something so important when it really comes down to a fascist takeover. You have to have the police and the military at least partially on your side. And that's why I think the analysis of January 6 riots really fall down, because we are not really told why the National Guard wasn't called out, why reinforcements weren't called out. This is the center of this largest democracy in the world, as we tout ourselves. This is the center of the military empire of the world. And yet, this country can't protect the Congress from an invasion of hundreds of people. You know, they were armed, they had shields, but really, what happened? Why weren't more troops not brought in? The CIA had prior knowledge of some of the plans. It looks like they didn't inform anybody. So I worry about January 6th, that in fact it wasn't just ineptitude. The army has plenty of ineptitude to go around. We all know that. But there's something else to January 6th, and to let this rage, this riot, actually enter Congress, beat people up, and kill people. And really, nothing was done about it. You know, there were troops that came in, National Guard troops. What happened? And the drift towards fascism makes me worry that the fascist elements, the Trump elements, had infiltrated both the police and the National Guard. I think that seems obvious to me. I think possibly more studies or more revelations will unlock the door and give us more of an estimate of how much Trump actually influenced the police and the military to let this riot go on, which had the possibility of killing a number of congressional senators and House of Representatives. And I think in the end we're going to find that the police and the military were partly responsible. I mean, I think that that's being kept from the American people. And I think if we knew more, we would be more upset about January 6th than we are. I think another really failure that should be included in this article, the failure of recognizing the importance of the disparity of wealth. Certainly the article refers to the disparity of wealth, but that's an underlying cause of fascism. And our U.S. media sometimes refers to it, sometimes runs articles about stories about poor people trying to feed their children. Even the latest issue of Jacobin has very good stories of people earning $15 an hour and not able to pay for this or that, or even pay for lunch or transportation. Yeah, the mainstream media doesn't do a bad job of talking about the desperation of the lower middle class in this country. But what gets left out is how important this disparity is to the spread of fascism. Because people who are angry and can't feed their children, they know that the system is broken, right? They know both parties are broken. They want to arm themselves and overthrow our government. And that's what fascism essentially is, that to divert the anger at social injustice and the injustice of the disparity of wealth, to funnel that anger into actually destroying the democracy. The two major parties aren't caring about this. The media doesn't care about it either. That's the danger, that we're still drifting. These things have to be brought up. These things have to be debated. and whether it's going to take overturning the two major parties to have a party that actually runs on workers' rights. That may have to happen if we're going to really avoid a fascist takeover in this country. Well, I'm going to go now to a song here, and this is on the special program. This is a song written by me and sung by me. It's called Chosen People. Let's listen to that.
Mein Führer, we salute you who stepped through the land. We all know the world is ours, wait for your command. Give us marching orders, Poland sure to fall. Our Reich will last a thousand years, I gotta set it all. Cause we're chosen people, God's only sons. What we do is always right, cause we're the Holy One. We'll take your land, we'll take your life. That's how the scripture reads. We got the word from up above to do its righteous deed. Our destiny awaits us, this land's our natural right. We'll take what God has given, we're meant to win this fight. The redskin, he's a savage, more animal than man. We'll rid the world of evil, kill us all we can. Cause we're chosen people, God's only son. What we do is always right, cause we're the Holy One. Yeah, we'll take your land, we'll take your life. That's how the scripture reads. We got the word from up above to do righteous deeds. This holy land's our birthright 2,000 years ago, and now it's filled with Arabs. We'll plague them till they go. We'll beat them and we'll starve them. Every mother's son, don't look to us for mercy until our land is won. Cause we're chosen people, God's only sons. What we do is always right, cause we're the Holy One. Yeah, we'll take your land, we'll take your life. That's how the scripture reads. We got the word from above to do righteous deeds. My Captain Columbus, this new world's made of gold. We'll fool them with religion, steal what ships can hold. We'll slice their brown bodies with our blades of steel, until our arms are weary, hearts no longer feel. Cause we're chosen people, God's only sons. What we do is always right, cause we're the Holy Ones. Yeah, we'll take your land, we'll take your life. That's how the scripture reads. We got the word from up above to do its holy deed. Yeah, we got the word from up above to do its holy deed.
All right. That was Chosen People, written and sung by myself, Fred Nagel. We're going to go to our guest now. Her name is Slado. Her English name is Molly Wickham. She's a spokesperson for the Gedempten Checkpoint, which is a reoccupation site established in 2018. She's a member of Kas Yakaz. That's called the Grizzly House of the Wet'suwet'en people. And she has reoccupied her territory in Canada since 2014. So let's go to Slado. All right, Slado, thank you so much for being on Activist Radio today.
Thanks for having me.
You have a marvelous website. I just spent a lot of time on that website. Great graphics, pictures, and so much information. I was really amazed. Did you just put that website up, or have you had that for a while?
No, it's been up for a while, since I think 2019.
Yeah. I'm going to put a link to the website so that people listening to this can just click on the link and learn really about the entire the battle over territory, the battle over a pipeline that's going in, so that people can be more informed. It's actually www.yinbahaccess.com. And I'll say it one more time, www.yinbahaccess.com. And again, I'll put that right on the Class Wars website. You describe the relationship between your peoples and the Canadian government as a toxic relationship. And how has that been toxic? And does that go way back, or is it worse now with the pipelines trying to push through First Nations territory?
I mean, there are a lot of similarities now between what had happened at First Contact and when the Canadian government tried to move in and take our territories. They did a lot of undermining of our traditional governance system, which is something that's occurring right now with the band council systems. So they are attempting to undermine our hereditary chief and our clan governance system and go to the elected band councils to get permissions to go into territories. They've also had a history of burning us out of our territories, burning down our homes, destroying our homes and our communities, and putting us on reserves. And that's the exact same thing that's happening today. They destroyed Gedempten Checkpoint in 2019, and most recently at Coyote Camp, where the drill pad is, they destroyed cabins, tiny homes, and bulldozed down all of our infrastructure.
And this is actually land that essentially belongs to your people then?
Yes, it has. We have 22,000 square kilometers of territory that we've never ceded, surrendered, or lost in war. And in 1997, the Delgamuukw Stayaway Court case in the Supreme Court ruled that we had never extinguished title to our lands.
That's an amazing accomplishment right there. You know, that you had been able to resist the takeover since the beginning, quite amazing. The website refers to a submission to the UN, and I read that. That's a very impressive document. Pretty much how Canada violated UN declarations on the right of Indigenous peoples. Can you tell us a little bit about that submission to the UN? Did you go down to the UN to submit that, or how did you do that?
We've made a couple of different submissions to the UN. We made a submission to the CERD, to the Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination, a few years back, and in turn they responded and wrote to Canada and told them that they need to stop the construction of the Coastal GasLink pipeline, the site feed dam, and the Trans Mountain pipeline, until they had the consent of the Indigenous people. Canada did not do anything about that. They ignored that request from the UN And so we feel like, you know, this recent one on the militarization of Wet'suwet'en territory is just one more thing to add to Canada's reputation. A lot of people see Canada as, you know, a country that has good relationships with the Indigenous people, and we want to hold them accountable and make sure that people are aware of what is actually happening on the ground. They have a lot of rhetoric around reconciliation, that we have not seen that in real life on the ground. Mm-hmm. They have not put, you know, real policies and laws in place that actually back up the UN. And in British Columbia, where Wet'suwet'en territory is, they've actually passed, you know, legislation to say that they have to align their laws with the UNDRIP, and they're not making moves to actually make any real differences or align themselves with the UN.
The Coastal GasLink pipeline, is it a danger to your people? And why does it have to go through your territory? Isn't there any other way to get the pipeline to where it wants to go?
Yes, there was a proposed alternate route years back when the Wet'suwet'en were first, you know, considering this project, and the company refused to have conversations about that. This pipeline specifically would go through, is planning to drill underneath Wet'suwet'en, which is our main river system and the headwaters to many of the rivers downstream. That's home to our salmon population. It's a huge spawning ground, a very important sacred place to us, and it's also one of the last clean drinking water sources in our territory. And we know that even just if everything went right and they drilled under the river according to their own, you know, environmental standards and whatnot in the country, it would still destroy our drinking water and could still have devastating effects on our salmon population.
I think I may have mentioned to you when I spoke to you before about the fact that I went to Standing Rock, you know, as part of the U.S. military. There were a lot of First Nation peoples there. They go into the armed services in the United States quite often because it offers them economic opportunity that maybe they wouldn't be able to get if they didn't do that. But at Standing Rock, they had done a lot to show how leaky these pipelines are. They have small leaks that destroy acres and acres, but it's not just one huge eruption. These pipelines, the technology is flawed, and wherever they're laid, and they had videos of these swamps just filled with oil, and it wasn't a major spill, it was just a minor spill. So are these Canadian pipelines as apt to spill environmentally destructive elements on your land as well?
Absolutely. And one of the interesting things about this pipeline is it's a fracked gas pipeline. And so they're getting fracked gas from northeastern so-called British Columbia. But they are building the pipes in order to also transport bitumen. So fracked gas pipelines only require a certain width of steel or metal for for the pipe, and they only have to be a certain size. But the pipes that they are building and bringing in are pipes that could carry bitumen. And so in previous projects, they've asked the communities and promised the communities that we will promise to only ship fracked gas or gas through the pipe for up to 5 years. And then after that, they can switch it to bitumen. But the other thing to consider that's really important is that fracked gas is not a transitional energy like they claim it is. It's not a clean energy at all. The way that they get the fracked gas out of the ground is devastating to the drinking water, and those communities are experiencing earthquakes. They can't drink their water anymore. There's gas in their territories. And once they would get it to completion and to the LNG Canada facility, they would be burning their own fracked gas in order to power the LNG liquefaction plant, which is very toxic and would contribute to 4.5% of Canada's total carbon emissions per year.
Amazing. Amazing. How is it that First Nations are really one of the front lines against climate change? Does this go back to Indigenous culture or living closer to the land? Why do you think that your people care about the climate seems to be a great deal more than other people?
I mean, I think it all goes back to our laws. You know, in Wet'suwet'en, our laws are called Anak'noten, and that's our body of laws that derive from the land and our relationship to it. And so in upholding our laws, it comes very naturally that we would have to protect the territory. You know, we're not protecting the territory just for the sake of our well-being and our future generation. Those things are very important, but we also take into consideration our responsibility to all other living things on our territory, to the water, to the animals, and to all of their future generations. And so we have this unique relationship to the land that our governance system is built from. And we have to uphold our laws and our systems, and we can't do that without the land. You know, our elders say the land is, we are the land and the land is us. And it's very true in our culture and our way of life.
That's so interesting, the to be linked to the land like that. And one could only wish that more people on the earth felt that link, because maybe we wouldn't be in this catastrophic position of a warming climate if more people took responsibility or maybe saw the links to the environment and the people. You've had some really large military invasions, police raids on your territories. Can you describe what's happened on these raids? You've had three raids in, what, the last 3 years?
Yeah, so the police, they have a special unit of police just to deal with Indigenous land defenders protecting their territories, and they're called the CIRG. They're the Community Industry Response Group. And so their only job is to go in to communities where industry is trying to push through project and protect industry so that industry can push through an unceded land. And so these militarized raids have cost millions of dollars. In 2 years, they spent $20 million policing the Wet'suwet'en alone. That's not including this last year's raid where they had 75 to over 100 RCMP CIRG members and police with tactical units, canine units, lethal overwatch snipers, and have forcibly removed Indigenous people, Wet'suwet'en people, from our own land at gunpoint, and then criminalized us and jailed us. And so this is not something that, like, this is something that has been happening to Indigenous people, you know, since contact. This is not something that we should be seeing in 2022 or 2019 or 2020. These are just absolutely, you know, violations of human rights, of Indigenous rights, extreme violence by the state to Indigenous people. And, you know, we have a lot of support, non-Indigenous supporters, and I feel like that's because they come to our territories and they see our relationship to the land, they see our governance structure, they feel that connection to our territories, and they want to stand up and support us and fight alongside us.
You are also, you get support from other tribes. The Iroquois has given you a lot of support, and your people are related to the Iroquois people. Is that correct? Bring up the Iroquois because they're in New York State. You know, this radio station's at Vassar College right in New York State. So I thought listeners would be interested in the connection to the Iroquois Nation,
yes,
which is fighting its
Oh, sorry.
No, go ahead.
We have a very strong relationship with the Haudenosaunee people, and we, you know, we have an alliance between our hereditary chiefs have gone out and visited their people on the lands and met with their people, and they've come here and met with our people and have been on our territories. And so we have that relationship, and we believe, you know, they have a clan system that's similar to ours. And we believe that we are relatives within each clan. So people that are Bear Clan are relatives of people who are Bear Clan here. And in the past, those relationships and those ties are historical. You know, we have many stories of our people traveling far, far distances and having relationships and intermarriages. And you know, we have that now today, where Wet'suwet'en people and, you know, the daughters of the chief, our head chief Was, are intermarried into the Haudenosaunee.
Interesting. You live in a house with your husband and three children. Is your house in danger? I mean, could they come and attack your house at any point using the Canadian military forces?
Absolutely. I don't think that anything out on our territory is safe right now. Like I said before, they have, the state and industry have a history of burning down our homes and our cabins and destroying them to remove us from the land. And so it's a huge concern of mine and for the safety of my family. You know, industry and the police can do whatever they want. After Coyote Camp, they burned down the House of Skyze, which was a cabin that was built on the territory and was opened during ceremony by Was himself, that his daughter was living in. And this police were there and had oversight over the whole area. Nobody was allowed in or out, and yet somehow it was burned to the ground. This is what they do to Indigenous peoples out here on our land.
Yeah, just amazing. Do you think these attacks, are the incursions on your territory all about money? I mean, there's a tremendous amount of money invested in these oil pipelines and in oil manufacturing itself, refining. Is it about money, or do you think there's a lingering racism that Canada doesn't really like to admit to the world, of course, but is it a combination, or do you think all this is just about big banks and investment firms, you know, making money on pipelines?
I think that it's about money, but they use racism and they have a racist ideology in how they deal with Indigenous people. And so historically, they use racism to dehumanize us, so that nobody cared, so that it became palatable and acceptable to burn Indigenous homes down and to move us onto reserves, because we weren't human enough to, you know, to deserve the same respect and the same, you know, behavior as non-Indigenous people. And so that is what's happening now, is that they don't recognize our system of governance. They don't recognize our way of life, our way of being with the land. And so because they want to push these projects through for profit, they're using racism, and they are experiencing racism, you know, and using it as a tool in order to remove us from the land. You know, if we're savages, if we are not as human as non-Indigenous people, then they feel like it's okay to go in and remove people from their homes. No, it's not as common for them to do that to non-Indigenous people.
Part of your report to the UN has some interesting reading about how these Canadian armed forces, what they're instructed to do, their officers, and I'm going to just read a quote. Officers are instructed, quote, to use as much violence towards the gate as you want. Isn't that just such a blatant violation of human rights that these police forces are told to, it's up to them how much violence they want to use against you. In fact, it encourages racist police to use their own judgment.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And in that case, in particular, when they were saying use as much violence as you want towards the gate, there were people that were attached to the gate when they were using as much violence as they wanted, which they were using chainsaws. They were people were attached to the gate and they were pulling on the gate, pulling it, and they would have broken people's arms had they, had we not done something about it. And they didn't care, and they knew, and we were showing them pictures of it and pleading with them to stop, that they were going to seriously injure people, and they just looked us in the face, didn't say anything, and continued on.
And then you have reports of the racist talk about genocide, which is really it's sort of hard to comprehend how anybody would threatens somebody with genocide, but some of their talk is extremely racist as well, and nobody seems to try to limit that either. So you're up against an awful lot, a lot of power. And I'm wondering if other indigenous peoples around the world have come to your support, and do you support them? Is there an emerging force of indigenous people around the world?
Absolutely. I think other indigenous people around the world see what's happening here and they can relate to it because they've had similar experiences. They have the same experiences of colonization and ongoing colonization and destruction of our lands and our culture and our way of life. And, we've definitely had other Indigenous people reach out to us, and we've started relationships with them, and we share information, about how, what things are happening here and how we've dealt with certain things. And, it's this camaraderie that we know that we're all in this situation right now together.
Yeah, that must be a huge help, because people are going to invent other tactics in Bolivia, maybe, or Brazil, that you could use as well against people taking over your land. We're pretty much out of time. I have one question. It's actually a big question, but these pipeline work camps, are they a danger, especially to Indigenous women and girls? And has that been documented in Canada? Is there a large assault on Indigenous women and girls as a result of these pipelines?
Absolutely. It's been well documented. There's been a lot of research around it. Even in the inquiry into murdered and missing Indigenous women in Canada, fully documented and researched and made as a recommendation that any man camps within Indigenous territories, there has to be special precautions and special policies and special procedures put in place to limit the harm, because it is so severe that, we live on a stretch of highway that's called the Highway of Tears, because we've had so many of our Indigenous women go missing and been murdered on this highway. And this is where they're putting all the man camps in our territory, is in this area. And so we have a highly increased number of men working in our communities that are transient, that are putting our women at risk in our communities, that have no connection to our communities, no accountability. And with a lot of drugs and alcohol happening, there's been an increase in gang violence, an increase in violence, domestic violence, everything in our communities since this project has come in.
And then I promise this will be the last question. On your webpage, you talk a lot about the resistance and how people can help your people resist this pipeline. And you talk a lot about investments. As a matter of fact, you even have a template email for your supporters to fill out and send in. So you want to talk about that resistance, how listeners to this today can be part of resisting the pipeline and supporting your people?
Absolutely. So there are a lot of actions. The owners of this company are KKR, which is a private equity company, AIMCo, which is actually a private investment company in Alberta that holds the RCMP's retirement funds, and then TC Energy. And so we're also looking at, so there's organized actions around those companies, but we're also looking at the major banks that are investing. And so JP, Morgan Chase, the five big Canadian banks, RBC is at the top of the list, TD Bank. And so we have some campaigns happening against those banks to get them to pull out of the genocide of Indigenous people and to let them know exactly what's happening on the ground. So that can all be seen on our website if people go and visit our website, and keep following along in order to watch, you know, the next call outs for what people can do and the actions that people can do to support us.
Great. Well, it's a horrifying story, Slato, but I want to thank you so much for telling it. It must not be easy to go over these things, and you know, it just seems like it's a continuation of a very shameful history. But thank you so much for being on Activist Radio today and telling us about it.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for sharing our story.
Thank you. All right. Bye now.
Bye-bye.